Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is
Neat.
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
So it's March.
It is March. You're right.
And so there's a drinking holiday that we get to celebrate in March.
Is it Women's History Month? Drink every day?
If you're a woman, you're allowed to drink every day because of sexism. No, that's every day of the year.
Yeah, okay.
No, we got St. Patrick's Day coming up.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
I'm like a lot of randomly people in the United States have some Irish in me somewhere.
Well, this is it. This is your day.
Oh, yeah. Only like a small percentage my day.
You get like an hour.
Okay. How much do you get?
I don't know.
Do you know how much percentage you are? I feel like everybody, like all like just nondescript white people in the United States have some kind of Irish somewhere.
I feel like I'm just so deluded. Like if I did it a 23andMe, it would just come back with like a picture of a jar of mayonnaise. This is you.
There you have it. Very relatable content.
I accept that. I'm okay with that. So St. Patrick's Day, your tiny little 1% of Irish will celebrate for both of us.
For sure. You won't be celebrating?
I'll celebrate. We're going to celebrate. We're going to celebrate across two episodes.
We will. We've got a special episode today and we got a special episode next week. So you just get ready for that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just not a lot of drinking holidays. I mean, I guess on every holiday you can drink. It's an option.
Yeah, I mean, you try hard enough. Every holiday can be a drinking holiday.
You're true. You ever had an
Arbor Day daiquiri? Make it a thing.
It's a thing now.
Now it's a thing. All right, so we got an actual drinking holiday to talk about. So we're gonna get a couple episodes out of it.
Right. We'll save the actual St. Patrick's Day content for next week, but we'll just start with Ireland. How's that?
How is Ireland? Well I wouldn't know.
I've been there once.
Me too.
Cool.
Yeah,
great. We have the same amount of real world experience.
well I might not know a lot about what's going on in Ireland right now. I do like talking about Irish whiskey.
Oh, I love that. That's all the preparation we've done for this episode.
That's what we can talk about, yes. Irish whiskey. Hey, we're going to tell you about Irish whiskey now.
Let's do it. Wouldn't you know, it was started by some of our favorite people we like to talk about.
We love these dudes, these broskies, always up to something, always spreading the good knowledge about booze around the world.
Yes, those monks.
We got some Irish monks.
Yeah.
Say what you will about religion, and there's a lot to say there, but boy, they just spread distillation knowledge everywhere.
They sure do. So I guess the widely believed lore around here, and there's a lot of evidence to support this, that Irish monks were actually traveling during the 11th and 12th century, and maybe even before, and they picked up some distillation knowledge in their travels to the Mediterranean and Arabia.
But it was perfume
distillation. Yeah, it wasn't the thing that we want to get to. It was perfume. But I guess somewhere
they looked at that and said, there's potential here,
you know,
to consume that.
This would be better if I could drink it. Yeah, so they modified the technique a little bit so that they were able to drink it and have a little fun with it, you know? What they were making then was actually really different from the spirit that we know now. It wasn't aged. It was perhaps maybe a little closer to what we would call white whiskey or white dog today. Mm-hmm. But then it also had like a lot of botanicals in it, flavored with like mint, thyme, anise. There's actually a company that started in the 1960s called Irish Mist that makes something that is supposed to be really close to that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's cool. I'd like to try that.
Yeah. That would be cool. Let's see if, I don't know, let's see if we can get our hands on that. But the word whiskey, I mean, the first thing that comes up, I'm sure you came across this. I know you came across this. I'm not going to pretend like I don't know that you came across this. We've been practicing how to say these words.
Yes.
Whiskey comes from the Gaelic ishkabaha, which means water of life.
Right, which is like the aquavit or aquavite or eau de vie. Mm-hmm. Like lots of cultures have that base translation, which I think all derives from Latin.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And then I guess later, at some point, it became fuisca, which sounds more like whiskey.
Give me some fuisca. I've definitely had people that have ordered it that way for me, and they've maybe had a little bit too much.
Maybe they had a little bit too much fuisca.
Yeah. When it starts sounding like the original Gaelic for whiskey, I know they've had too much whiskey.
Yeah, there you go. That's how you know. That's a good meter. Good measure. Okay, so here's the thing, though. So Ireland and a lot of places around this region have a really rich oral history and not a very good like record. So the first we know that they were making whiskey way before this, but the first record of whiskey being a thing is from 1405, and it was in the Annals of Clonmacnoise, which I am not going to pretend like I said right at all, because I don't know. And the record is actually about a guy drinking it and dying. Mm. So Richard...
What a great testament to early whiskey.
Yeah, yeah. It's, yeah. I mean, you know, it did the job, didn't it? Perhaps we can say that he died happy? I don't know. Speculation. Anyway. So this guy, Richard McGranell, chieftain of Manitriolis, died at Christmas by taking a surfeit of aquavite. And the quote goes on, and this is a translation, obviously, but the quote goes on to... Mine author saith that it was not aquavite to him, but aquamortis. Not water of life, but water of death.
Did that guy just pun? And like he just made like a play on words, like, oh, this guy died.
Yeah, he
whoops.
Did.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I mean, but like, obviously at this time it's not regulated. So drinking alcohol in general is pretty risky.
I think having respect for other people's loss of life was regulated by then.
Okay,
maybe not. This is
I don't know.
It's 1400s. Where are we at?
Yeah, probably I don't not. Know. They probably don't. I mean, life is pretty short back then. They probably don't give a shit. But now, I mean, speaking of the risk you take by drinking alcohol during this time. Now for a little story time. This is what I took from when I was visiting Ireland. I went to, of course, as you do, I went to the Irish Whiskey Museum, and
Liz heard a lot of facts, and the one that she liked the most is the morbid one. So yeah. Enjoy this.
Okay,
you do like talking about death.
I'd like to talk
more on that later.
Oh. Don't hatch all my eggs now. It's okay.
Don't hatch all my eggs now is not a thing that people say.
I are you sure?
Don't count your eggs before they hatch.
Well, but...
My dude!
They're not your eggs.
Don't hatch all my eggs now.
My eggs aren't ready to
hatch.
That
doesn't mean anything.
Anyway, so I had a really good, a really, really cool guide to the museum. And this is the story that I took away. So she told our tour, I believe her name was Sarah. Sarah, if you're listening, you're amazing. Love you. Biggest fan. So she told us a little lore about what was happening during this time of unregulated distillation, some of which I can confirm with some research that I did, and some may be speculation, but either way, pretty fun story. What happened a lot was that during distillation, you'd have everything in a vat, and the liquid separates into three layers. The heavy stuff is at the bottom, the drinkable stuff is in the middle, and the top is straight methanol. We talked about this a little bit when we did our Alewives episode.
Right.
So like how... the alewives would be accused of being witches because somebody drank some of their stuff and they got sick or they died or they went into a coma. As can happen when you drink methanol. So, you know, they would scoop the drink from the top. If you were the unlucky one that got that one, then you might just fall into a coma. And This is the same time in history where there's like a lot of disease, you know, like plague, cholera, you name it, whatever. There's stuff going on. And there was a lot of people dying. So graveyards are getting kind of full. You know, they're getting kind of crowded. So you have to disturb some of the grave sites to make some room. But what they found in some of the coffins was even more disturbing. They found a lot of
vampires.
That would be cool. I think the origin of vampires might come from this too.
Yeah, that's right. I think so.
That's a story for another time. Anyway, they found like a lot of interesting marks on the inside of coffins that seemed like people had been trying to claw their way out, which would suggest that people had been buried alive. And that's actually where that's where we get the bells in the graveyard thing. It's one of the reasons. Some people believe that ringing the bells meant that the spirit was actually leaving the body, but it's actually more likely that this practical reason that they were afraid of burying people alive might have been a thing, except for it was really like if the wind is blowing and like the bells are ringing and you don't know what's going on. And also that's really fucking scary. That's really creepy. If like bells are ringing in a graveyard, I don't know if you'd have enough time to dig people up in time because you really only have a little bit of oxygen left. If you woke up underground.
Yeah.
Although
you just do the four finger punch
the
bride punch.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you do the zombie.
I don't know, I said four finger punch. That's not what it was called. Sounds like a sex thing.
I guess a punch has four fingers and a thumb.
It does. It's all the punches. Yeah, most punches.
But also something that comes from this that's like a little bit. There's like a lot of more evidence to suggest that this is actually the origin of the Irish wake, which is a really big thing. Like, it's a 3-day wake. It's pretty long. And it used to be that there were several attempts made to revive the corpse, like having them smell like smelling salts and even like dancing with the corpse to try to get it to back to life. Of course, this is not going to work. If you're in a methanol coma, then like you're gonna be in a coma until it gets out of your system, so like no amount of dancing is going to bring you back. But that was supposed to be the purpose of doing this wake, just in case you might wake up again.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's something fun that comes from the unregulated distillation of whiskey in Ireland at this time. Yeah,
dancing with corpses.
Yeah, and I mean
being buried alive.
Yeah,
good times.
I mean, there were definitely some improvements made. Like they changed the vat a little bit. They put the tap at the bottom instead of scooping it off the top.
Yeah, they definitely did that. They did that. Yeah, that was
probably a smart move. Probably good.
Well, and I think this is stuff that comes from home distilling more than anything.
Definitely.
Because, I mean, at the same time, we had like the way that the monks were distilling, they had this stuff figured out. It's when other people started doing it at home.
Oh yeah, I don't think the monks were killing anybody.
No, I think that they were pulling from the bottom. I think it was people got home and did their own thing, and they were pulling from the top.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's right. You gotta leave it to the monks. You know, monks do their thing,
or
find out what's going on.
Yeah, you don't need a monk to make your booze. Just
find out how to do it.
Pay attention to the part of the science that can kill you. That's my motto in life.
That's a good motto. And then like from then, you got the 1500s. Irish whiskey is picking up some steam, starting to gain some fans. Queen Elizabeth I in 1541 had stocks of Irish whiskey delivered to her court. That's a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you have like some developments around that time too. Pretty big stuff going on.
Well, I mean, I think that the British recognition of Irish whiskey also leads to, I mean, really one of the most important transformative things with Irish whiskey happens around this time. Basically, the British realized that the Irish whiskey was massively successful. It was selling worldwide. It was a massive export, and so they wanted to get some of that money.
Oh yeah.
Which there'd been a lot of legislation before to try to control and like legislate this. One of the big things they did though was they taxed malted barley. Malted barley was at the time an essential ingredient for distilling Irish whiskey. To put it briefly, like, malting barley is just a specific way of drying barley. The way that the Irish got around this is by just saying, oh, that's cool. Well, then we're going to start using unmalted barley because you're not taxing us on that.
Because fuck you!
Yeah. So we're going to put it all in the same pot. We're going to put a little bit of the stuff that we get taxed on, a little bit of the unmalted stuff in there, and we're going to distill it that way, and then it'll be fine. And what that unmalted barley addition did was, for one, it added a lot of spice to the profile of Irish whiskey. It changed the mouthfeel. And the other thing it did is it really kind of encapsulated this idea of, like, the one pot, like the pot still, the copper pot still, as, like, a way of, like, capturing flavorful spirits.
Nice.
So it became essential to the production of old school Irish whiskey. Like, you use malted and unmalted barley, you use the copper pot still, and this style really, like, it's only briefly that this taxation happens, but even after it was lifted, the style became so popular that that was just the way that the Irish made whiskey after that.
Right, like, that's how we know whiskey as today. Like, traditional Irish whiskey, that's what we think of.
Yeah, yeah.
As a style.
It has those flavor notes, and it still has a very big emphasis on pot still. You'll see, like, it's not that whiskey can't be made in Ireland any other way, but Irish whiskey has that very distinctive flavor profile.
Nice.
I do want to talk about, because I'm kind of throwing those terms out there, like pot still.
What does that mean?
This is when that term kind of comes to relevancy, and it's going to matter a lot in the story of Irish whiskey, because there's another term that comes directly from this as well, as far as how we distill.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk about pot stilling, let me see if I can describe this in the most basic way, because it's a podcast. Please. And I only have words.
I need the words.
Here is a simple, simple way. You've got a big old copper pot, right?
All right.
You put in all of your fermented booze soup, right? Just all your stuff that you've let your yeast eat your sugar. You've got it all in there.
You got a nice booze soup.
You got booze soup. And what you want is, you want to pull that alcohol out. You want to pull that ethanol out. So you want it to evaporate, and you want it to condense, and you want to leave all the other shit behind, mm-hmm. right? That's how distillation works. So with a pot still, you have this big round basin pot still. You put it all in at once, all the liquid in. The ethanol evaporates. It brings a lot of other stuff with it. It condenses in, like, basically a tube, like a copper tube that runs off of the still that has cold water, like, rushing around it.
Okay.
So it chills it, and then it condenses in another container. So after all of your spirit has run through that is going to evaporate and condense, you have to take it all out, clean everything out, and then start it again.
So that's a lot of work.
There's a lot of time that's involved.
A labor of love.
Yeah. And then, you know, and it's not like you're still pulling the spirit out and reheating it. So it's like, as far as the clarity you're going to get, you'll get there, but it's a little bit rougher process. Ultimately, it provides, I mean, obviously, these methods can be done lots of different ways, but it provides a lot more flavor, mm-hmm. Is sort of the consensus pot still versus what is soon to come in other distilling methods. But this is really the origin of the emphasis on the pot still. It's not to say that there weren't people distilling in pots before that, but this is where we start talking about this term as, like, a style, a choice that you make for your spirit.
All right.
And that's going to matter pretty soon in the history of Irish whiskey, but not right away, because we're still in the, like, 1700s, early 1800s. All right. So I'm gonna pick up with the history of Irish whiskey, I guess. Now the ball's in my court. You toss it to me. I'll keep going.
Hey.
All right.
You caught that ball.
Irish whiskey, super popular, has developed a distinct style at this point in time. It's about to run into a couple snags in its success.
Oh, no.
A lot of stuff is going on in Ireland around this time. We're talking about, like, early in the 19th century. I mean, there's the massive famine that happens in Ireland that leads to a lot of emigration, people leaving the country.
Yeah, that was big news. Big news back then.
Yeah. There's also a pretty powerful abstinence movement, or prohibition movement, that happens in Ireland around this time.
That kind of abstinence.
Yeah, I said that. I was like, no. Oh, no, we can't have sex with Jameson anymore. No, so you know, people are abstaining from drinking. There are a lot of other factors, but through this all, Irish whiskey still continues to be one of the dominant spirits in the international marketplace. It stays that way until really, like, the turn of the century, when one big invention starts the path of the downfall of Irish whiskey and kind of just runs into a bunch of other stuff.
Oh no. So what happened?
That is, so before I told you about the pot still, now I'm going to talk about the column still.
Oh.
Arch nemesis of the pot still. That's not actually true. They're just different methods and we use them for different effects. But at the time,
It was bad news bears.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, the column still, the continuous still, which I'll give you the mechanics in a second, it was actually partially invented by an Irishman. This is in the 1830s, a man by the name of Aeneas Coffey.
Good name.
Yes, a very good name. He created a more streamlined way of distilling. So as I mentioned before, in pot stilling, you have to clean everything out. You only get one pass on the distillation before you have to restart it. It's a very time-consuming process, mm-hmm. and it's not necessarily providing like utmost clarity. Well, what he realized is if you just kind of connect multiple stills together and you can have a spirit continue to distill one, two, three times. So it kind of goes up, condenses, and then you have one clarity level. It goes up and condenses again, and you have another clarity level.
Oh, nice.
So this allows for something that's called continuous distilling, where you can just keep feeding spirit into it and getting it to like distill down to where you want it, to the clarity level that you want it, to the proof that you want it, and you're not wasting that time in between, like cleaning it out, putting in a new batch.
Okay.
So it speeds up the process. It changes it. You get a different product from this method, but you get higher purity levels, I guess, mm-hmm. is the best way to put it, and higher concentrations of alcohol this way. Now, the Irish look at this and kind of say, no, we don't want that.
No, like, we're good.
Our methods create our signature product, why would we change anything? Mm-hmm. But the Scottish, who up until now, while they had been making whiskey, they had not overtaken Irish whiskey at any point in time, they love the column still.
Oh yeah.
They love the continuous still. So they start making a lot of blended whiskeys.
Mm.
And it's, you know, it's competitive price-wise. It's easier to make. It's a lot more mellow of a flavor. Mm. Which was pretty popular to the emerging market. I like there's like Irish distillers recorded at the time that said that it was a silent spirit. That's what they didn't like about it. It didn't have anything to say.
They didn't like that it didn't punch you in the mouth.
Yep, yep.
It didn't insult your mother and slap your sister.
That's what you want from your Irish whiskey, right? You just want it to come out of the glass and smack you around. But no, these nice blended Scotch whiskeys did not do that. And they even tried to contest this. Like, you know, there was a move to like say, well, this can't be whiskey. We can't call this whiskey. And I think it was in 1909. Yeah, 1909, the Royal Commission on Whiskey would state that it doesn't matter what still it comes from, that continuous still whiskey is still whiskey.
Like, yep, that's whiskey.
That's whiskey to me.
We'll take it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Interesting to note, so the only thing that comes to mind as far as the coffee, the man who invented it, if you've ever seen the Japanese whiskey, Nika Coffee Grain, I know because I've been on tastings where people go like, oh, I can taste the coffee. It's named after the man that created the still. There's no coffee involved.
So what you're tasting is your imagination.
Yes. Coffee with a Y. And there are other products out there that make mention of that or reference or they just, you know, that's the coffee that's involved in the distilling method. All right. So this was the start of the kind of bad times to come for Irish whiskey. Scotch whiskey was becoming more and more competitive in the marketplace. But that was just really an inkling of all the unfortunate shit that was to come.
Oh no, there's more.
I was going to go into each thing individually, but there's just so much of it. So here you go. Here's what the latter half of the century looked like for Irish whiskey. There was World War I. There was the Easter Rising. There was the Irish War of Independence that caused export restrictions. There was Prohibition in America that killed their largest export market. Of course, Prohibition was going to come into the story. Also, on an extra note there, the Scots were fine with sending their bootleg liquor to America to be sold, but the Irish were very much like, we won't do that. And then compounding that, a lot of people made stuff that they called Irish whiskey and put it out in America, which ruined the reputation of Irish whiskey because that stuff was garbage. So more bad stuff, more bad stuff. On top of that, the Irish Civil War, the Anglo-English Trade War, the Great Depression. It was just one hit after another of things that damaged their ability to be on the international market, export, produce regularly.
Irish whiskey just can't catch a break.
Can't catch a break. I mean, this goes all the way up until like the 1950s. There were just 5 distilleries left in Ireland.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
They have dwindled.
They recognized that they needed some help. So these distilleries banded together.
Oh.
Yeah. They called themselves the Irish Distillers Limited. The Irish Distillers Limited. And they include the likes of Jameson, Powers, Cork Distillers. Eventually Bushmills got involved. This all kind of coalesced in the 1960s. And they put their efforts into like helping each other out, really. This is when like the Jameson Brewery moved to Cork so that all of the Irish distillers, like pot stilled liquors, was still in the same spot. They made a mass, like kind of supported the ad campaign behind Jameson into the 70s that got it back into the international market. So this was kind of a saving move. All of these brands joining together did kind of create like a superpower that other much smaller brands of Irish whiskey have had to contend with. But you know, ultimately it got the style back out there on an international marketplace.
Oh yeah, I'd say like it seems like they needed that kind of conglomerate move to happen to lay the groundwork for smaller distilleries to get back out there. Because now we really like care about, we love like the idea of small batch or like like a small business, like supporting a small business or like a really small brand. We like that now. It's kind of like it's part of like that, like the craft distillation thing.
Yeah. Well, that's
it's trendy.
And that's definitely like when you look at like what you see available from like in the category of Irish whiskey now, obviously everybody knows Jameson, everybody knows Bushmills, like Powers, Tullamore Dew. Like there are a lot of brands out there that have established, I would say, like high market dominance, like
world recognition.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely correct in like because of our modern sort of embracing of cocktail culture, of having like, you know, really nicely filled out beverage portfolios that like showcase what the world has to offer, there has been a growing place for smaller Irish whiskeys, for more like exactly what we're talking about, like artisanal brands. So it's so really on both sides of the category, you're seeing a lot of growth. There's been a boom in Irish whiskey, which is not different than the boom in every other spirit that's happening in the past like 10-15 years. But definitely this has affected Irish whiskey.
Yeah, and that's cool.
Yeah, like there are even like a lot of brands like Redbreast, Green Dot. Powers has a line called John's Lane that is kind of trying to go back to the very original like pot stilled style and getting that out there. So it's really cool. The category is expanding. It's elevating in some directions. It's becoming more affordable in other directions. So it's still out there and kicking despite a lot.
It's been through a lot.
Yeah.
But it's still here. That's pretty cool.
I mean, Jameson is the one we all know. It's one of the top 20 spirits in the world.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of history there, too.
Oh, yeah. Jameson has done very well for itself.
Yes.
I'm sure there's not even a stain or a spot on their record, right?
Well, we're going to get this out of the way up front. We're going to give you some interesting Jameson facts here.
This is a leading question.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to go ahead and get this one out of the way because it's the most possible bummer. If you're sensitive to bummers, maybe skip the next couple of minutes of this.
Skip ahead. We'll say maybe 5 minutes.
So Liz, I know you like murder.
Come on.
So because you like murder, I'm gonna tell you a story that's about murder.
Can you please stop saying that I like murder?
Okay, like, you like.
Okay, I find it interesting.
All right,
I find the stories interesting. Not in a creepy way, just like in a like fascination is in like the way that you can't look away from a train wreck. I don't get enjoyment out of murder.
I mean, it's funny because the way that you're trying to defend yourself right now, I think is exactly how one of the heirs to the Jameson fortune would have defended himself.
Okay, I'm going to stop right now. Just, you know what? Tell the story because I know you've done a lot of research into this and we'll talk about it.
Well, okay. Here's a little bit of a morbid story from the possible annals of Jameson history. But it comes up a lot when you look up Jameson history. And so I kind of wanted to go into the, like, get around the sort of crazy headline story and see what's true, what's not. We're just kind of go into what we know, what we don't know.
Yeah, let's just tackle it head on.
So the founder of Jameson, John Jameson, his great-grandson,
maybe great-great-grandson,
the timeline is a little questionable.
It's a little fuzzy. A lot of facts about this are a little fuzzy, but that's like the first thing that people are not really willing to nail down. It is unquestionably a kind of grandson.
It is a grandson of the founder of Jameson. He, at the time, was the heir to the Jameson fortune.
Yes.
His name was James Jameson, James S. Jameson.
To be specific.
Yes. Now, he was a traveler. He, like, led a lot of expeditions into Africa during the 1800s.
Okay, doesn't sound problematic at all.
Definitely problematic. So the story goes, he, at one point, paid to see somebody consumed by cannibals and sketch and then paint watercolors based on this.
You know, I'm gonna say that this is not sounding very good for James S. Jameson.
This no,
doesn't sound like a good guy.
No, I think, like, when we were doing some research, I was like, oh, I want to find some cool facts about Jameson. And this was the first thing that came up. I'm like, I don't... Okay, all right. Let's
see what's going on all right. here.
So he encountered this, you know, according to some stories, a group of natives that practiced cannibalism. He paid 6 white handkerchiefs to witness this with the hope of being able to paint it. And, you know, that's just, he's just a big old dickbag for doing that.
Yeah.
Is that the true story of what happened? Maybe, maybe not. The main account that's the most damning is from his translator at the time.
Okay.
Who said this. It said that this is what he did. He, you know, he paid this man. And the man that he paid, I should say, this is where it gets kind of sketch. He didn't pay, like, the leader of this tribe to, like, do this. He paid a slave trader.
Okay. So
it's hard to even say if there were actual, like, people that lived there, like a native tribe involved. He might have just paid a slave trader to do something awful in front of him. There's okay. that angle to
so
it.
So there's levels to this monstrosity. Yeah.
There was a lot of racism. Obviously, it was like cannibal and like tribesperson were almost used interchangeably.
It's not just racism. I think that's important to mention, that it's not just racism. It's like it's colonialism on compacted with racism and like the false portrayal of a lot of native people. Like, sure, there were probably, because there have been cannibalists throughout history, but mostly not.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on here.
Even the kind of perception of cannibalism from, this is just from other people that are, like, more studied in this. Even in tribes that did actually practice it, it was more of a ritualistic thing. It kind of related to bigger ceremonies. It wouldn't have been just something that strangers could walk into a village and say, there's something.
Right. No, that wouldn't have been a thing. Okay. No.
So there's a lot of questions into the original account that comes from the translator.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are two other accounts that kind of get considered in this. James Jameson himself, who kept a journal of it, in his journal, he kind of presents it more as like, he gives some handkerchiefs to this tribe. He did not expect the murder to happen. He did witness it, but it happened so fast that there's nothing he could do about it.
Okay, so he is saying that this was a misunderstanding.
So the other document is that he wrote a letter to his wife, also kind of defending himself. And in that, it's a crazy misunderstanding if his story is true. Because what he basically says is someone's like, you know, you could, like, give me some stuff and I'll, like, let you see somebody get killed in front of your eyes. And he's like, no way. No way. But here's some stuff anyway. And then he does it. He's like, I didn't want that to happen. Like,
that just doesn't... I mean, okay.
How did you think that was going to go, my bro?
Yeah, no, no. I mean, it's possible that he didn't actually expect for it to happen. But no, I'm not going to let him off the hook.
No.
No way.
Well, and the other thing is like, I mean, I think that the way this story gets skewed is it kind of presents it as like, oh, it's these cannibalistic tribes in Africa. It's like, no, you had slave traders active in Africa at the time who would have done a lot of horrible things for any sort of wealth.
Any amount of money.
Yeah.
Or exchange. Well, I mean, obviously not even money. Fucking handkerchiefs.
Well, that sounds a little like crazy at the time. Like, oh, six handkerchiefs. Like, that's nothing. But at the time, fine, like silk, fine linen would have been worth something. So the idea that he could have just paid a slave trader to do something atrocious, it's possible.
Right. And also, he wrote this letter while he was dying, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it kind of stands to reason that he might want to just, like, kind of clear up his legacy.
I mean, this letter also was magically produced, like, only after his translator came back. Because he died on this exertion of a fever. And his translator came back and started telling people what he did. And his wife was in, like, I have a letter where he said he didn't do any of that.
Seems sketch.
I don't know. What happened there? It's hard to say. I mean, there's also some accounts of historians saying, like, look, a lot of people buffed up their journals at the time to sound like they'd had more exciting, more dangerous adventures into other countries because that was a white people thing to do. So, you know, it's hard to say what happened. It does kind of sound like this guy was probably an asshole.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, in any case, it doesn't sound like he does not come out as a good person.
Anyone, because even in the story where he defends him, where he says, oh, I didn't want it to happen. It happened too fast that I couldn't do anything. I was scared. He does admit to, in all cases where he tries to defend himself, in both his journals and the letter, that he then went back to his tent and made some delicate watercolors about it, which I think if you've witnessed something like that and you're like, I'm just going to chill out and make some watercolors.
At the very least, it's in poor taste. Like, even in the best possible scenario of this circumstance, it's not good. It's bad. Hmm. It's very bad. I mean, sometimes you can't control who your descendants turn out to be, I guess.
And I will say the Jameson family, the Belgian government was heavily in control in a lot of these areas in Africa. Mm. So worked with them to kind of just get this talked about.
They tried to cover it up. That doesn't look good either.
It was also like the last like non-government expedition that went on under their guys. So it was definitely some people went like, oh, that was bad. We shouldn't let just whoever go.
No. Okay. All right. Well, they learned a little bit from this mistake, maybe?
It's hard to... There's some questionable facts here, but
oh, that's bad. You know what, let's talk about an also controversial figure for a lesser reason, not as controversial, John Jameson himself. And the controversy I'm referring to was the fact that he wasn't Irish at all.
That seems like a sweet rainbow and puppy controversy compared to what we just talked about.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's really not a big deal at all. All right. He was a Scotsman. He was a Scottish lawyer, actually. He came to Dublin when he was middle-aged and started this venture, which on like the Jameson website itself seems to be referred to as like, maybe this was a midlife crisis. I don't know. He seems to have had a good life back where he was, so we're not really sure why he decided to make this huge life change, but I mean, whatever, man, cool.
We like married into a new family though. Yeah, married the distillery was his wife's family's distillery in Dublin.
Okay, so it was a marriage.
Yes.
A marriage was what brings us to Dublin today.
Yeah, the girl that he married, they had a distillery in Dublin that he started out as the manager and then eventually became like the dude that runs it.
Okay, so not so much a midlife crisis because it wasn't really uncommon at this time to like all of a sudden marry a young wife and start a new life like that because she's got some kind of wealth and assets. That sounds pretty...
I just had a thought.
What was the thought?
You said you got that off the Jameson website, right? Speaking as somebody that works with brands, and I respect branding, I understand it. I have to be a brand. We all get branding. But is that an indication of the brand that Jameson is trying to sell to by being like, the founder of Jameson was just a guy having a middle-life crisis?
That's so midlife funny. Midlife crisis. Because that's actually on their website. They're like, this might have been a midlife crisis. Like,
I'm not joking. Okay, guys. Is that
That's your who you're trying to get in with?
Maybe.
I mean, it makes sense. Okay, Jameson brand. We see you. You're doing some stuff. Another thing that's very much part of the brand is the Jameson family motto that's on all of the bottles.
I don't know how to say it.
Well, it's Latin, so I'd say, I mean, it's probably sine metu.
Okay.
Because it's Latin, so we don't have to, like, really pronounce it right, you know?
Is that true?
I think that's true. I
it's
think
Latin, that's like, but we don't have to care. Who out there cares?
Right. I mean, like, people don't say Latin things in a Latin dialect.
I didn't even know they're...
Like,
okay.
I mean, like, you know, like, et tu, Brute? People say that. That's obviously not how they said it.
It's not?
Like, the way that I said it just now with, like, my Midwestern accent? No, well, they didn't say it like that.
Et tu, Brute?
They probably said, like, et tu, Brute? Like, something more Italian nice. Sounding, oh, okay. You know? What I'm saying is there's a lot of Latin things that
A lot of Latin things.
A lot of Latin things that we probably don't pronounce correctly because... no, there's no native speakers of Latin today, so they can't correct us. Sine metu means without fear, and it comes from a Jameson coat of arms that may have been awarded to them for fighting pirates on the high seas.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean,
pirate booze.
Yeah.
No, it's pirate fighting booze.
Pirate family fighting booze.
If you need to fight some pirates with your family, drink some Jameson.
There you
go. You don't need to appeal to people with midlife crises. You just use that as a
appeal
bad campaign.
To pirate fighters. That's pretty cool.
Pirate fighters.
Yeah, pirate fighters. You know, the pirate fighters.
The pirate fighters.
Yeah. So in the 1500s, the family were supposedly seamen, and I don't want to say that. The
seamen.
You know, the people that.
Semen. Say semen. Say it. Say semen. Semen.
They were
Wait, the word
semen.
You're looking for is semen.
They worked on boats.
Semen.
On ships.
Semen.
And okay. They battled pirates off of the coast of Scotland, and that's why they were awarded with this coat of arms.
That's pretty cool.
Of meaning without fear. Yeah.
That's badass. Cool.
I mean, I guess that's like, that goes right along with the decision to... you know, marry a young lady who's got a distillery lined up. You know, I was gonna say it goes with like your midlife crisis, but like that's not really what happens. So.
That's what I'm gonna do when I turn 40. I'm gonna go fight some pirates.
Yeah, without fear.
Without fear.
Yeah.
Another interesting fact that I enjoy about Jameson, this is actually true for a lot of liquor at the time, but you couldn't buy an actual bottle of Jameson until 1968. Before that, the labels were actually shipped with like the casks or barrels.
Oh.
And the bartenders would put it in the bottle themselves and label it.
That seems like a lot of work.
This was not, it wasn't just Jameson that did this, like a lot of liquor did this for a long time. It, you know, kind of like, if you want my spirit, you'll do it yourself. and this is where we get the term, like, if you've ever heard bottled and bond.
Oh, yeah.
So what that basically sort of comes from was this culture of, like, filling your own bottles meant that a lot of shady bartenders would mix it with water or dilute it a little bit to, like, stretch it. So what liquor distillers realized they needed to do was have some sort of quality control. So they started bottling themselves and also having people there at the bottling facility that would like make sure like yes it was put in the bottle at this proof.
I see. So, are you happy or sad that you don't bottle your own casks
that
now?
Would be terrible.
Yeah,
I would hate
like
that
a lot of work.
To have just like I'm just thinking of storage space and if every like liquor that I wanted to have on my back bar I had to have a cask of it upstairs. Like, I would hate that. Absolutely not.
That makes sense with, like, where it used to not be. I mean, we have, like, bars that are bar and restaurants now. Like, you wouldn't do that now. You'd just be a bar. You'd just be, oh, all we serve is alcohol. That's all we got space for.
Think about, like, a bar that has, like, 100 bottles on the back bar. Like, where do all those bottles go?
Yeah, no, you couldn't do that. You probably had like 5 bottles.
I'm waiting for like the super like artisanal bar that's just got like a I don't know, 20-foot stepladder with just barrels. It's the bartender hiking up and pouring you a fresh from the barrel half ounce for your cocktail.
That's your free idea of the week, folks. Somebody make it happen.
Please don't. Someone will get hurt.
Yeah. Jameson is doing even more with their brand now, right?
They are. So this is my last, I think, cool Jameson fact. Not that all of these were cool. This is my last interesting Jameson fact. There's not just Jameson. If you're out there and you're like, that's cool, I've had Jameson, it wasn't for me. There's actually a lot of Jameson out there now. They've done a lot of different stuff with their juice. And I personally think it's really cool. I really like a lot of it. As somebody that wasn't like, I personally, as far as whiskey goes, do not, Irish whiskey is not my favorite style. Preference.
People
not,
have preferences.
Yeah. But I love some of the other stuff that they've done around it. My favorite series is the Castmates series. It was an idea. It's a very cute story behind it. Like, it was born at a bar. The head whiskey scientist at Jameson, which is a great title.
That is, I want that title. Yeah. I mean, I'm years and years from ever achieving that, but that sounds great.
I mean, new goals. Somebody gets it. There's at least one in the world. So he was at a bar with a local beer brewer in the neighborhood, and they kind of came up with this idea to take used beer barrels and put Jameson in them to give it a beer finish.
Ooh.
So the first one that they did was a stout. They've since done like two different IPAs. They're really cool. If you're a beer drinker, if you're a Jameson fan, like if you just love like whiskey with cool finishes on it, I think it's really cool. The stout happens to be my favorite, but the IPA is also really cool. And outside of that, they also have done Jameson Black Barrel, which is a spirit I've worked a lot with. For that, they're definitely trying to cash in on more of the bourbon drinker market. They're taking the whiskey barrels that they age their Jameson in and then giving them like a super deep char. So it's got a lot more smokiness, a lot more like barrel flavor. It mellows it out a little bit, kind of takes that edge off of it. And it's really nice. Like, if you're a fan of Jameson and bourbon, Jameson Black Barrel is kind of the perfect spirit for you. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, they're doing a lot of cool stuff. And I think it makes sense because they're kind of trying to have a hand in both sides of the market. Like, Jameson is always going to dominate as far as a necessary back bar spirit. Mm-hmm. It's hard to be a bar and not have a bottle of Jameson. That's just true. Like, you can't. You have to have it. But with some of these specialty, like, liquors, some of these specialty finishes, they're definitely starting to penetrate the kind of cocktail culture market. And that's smart because that's the other side that things are really selling well on right now. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah.
They just came out with I've only got to play around with a little bit. I don't know how big the release is going to be, but they just made a cold brew.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's just a bottle that contains Jameson whiskey that's been infused with coffee. There's not like a lot of sweetener to it either. It's just Jameson and coffee.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's an Irish coffee, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know,
without the cream.
Yeah.
You know,
but yeah, it's definitely like just kind of a cocktail in a bottle.
Hey,
super cool.
I mean, why not?
Yeah.
Perfect blend.
Yeah. All right. Well, all right. So this is our little introduction to some Irish, history, some booze stuff. Join us next week we're going to be talking about St. Patrick's Day. I think it's important to have a one-on-one on any drinking holiday because people just go out and drink and they don't know why they're drinking. So we're gonna give you that information. But also, as a bartender, I want to make a plea of some etiquette to follow if you're going to be out drinking. So
it's going to be some real informative stuff. Going to come out right before St. Patrick's Day. You can relax, check that out, and you know, think twice about your actions on the holiday.
Yeah. Now if you bop over to our YouTube channel, we're going to be making some Irish whiskey cocktails.
We sure will. I'm excited about that. That's going to be fun. Yeah. And, you know, speaking of our YouTube channel, you can check out all our stuff out there. You can also check out more of our content on our Patreon. Thank you to all of our patrons. Thanks to all our new Patreon members. It's really cool to see you guys there because we really couldn't keep making this without you. And we're really excited that we have monthly gifts now for our starting at $1 up to $5. And if you want to donate more in the future, we're going to work on some special stuff for you too. But please check that out. That's going to be in our show notes. Thank you to everyone who tweeted and retweeted about the show. It really helps us get the word out. Purple Worm, Michael Beck, Terry Reeves, Karen B, Joseph Shoemate, Tommy Smurl, Austin Wills, Mary Smurl, Vina, Lock Changuita Woke, Jay Longois, Perfect Spirited, Dorothy Hoover, Stephanie Cooperstein, Joe March, Jeeves the Scottish Bunny, Ashley, AJ Brodsky, Reginald, Chris Bennington, Mia Smash, Witching and Bitching, Moki Motel, Abigail Hennigar, Sydney McElroy, Justin Dark Frog Home, Alec Wolf, Caitlin Wurzinski, Devin Nunez Stool, Corey, Mary Clutter, Blake One Hair Elgara, Rat Baby. You guys have some good names. I'm not making them up. Some people don't have their real names on Twitter for their profile, I decided to just call y'all out by your usernames, by your handles. So that's what I'm reading. So if you put something dumb as your handle on Twitter, I'm going to read it on our podcast. That's a guarantee. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NeatBoozeCast. Thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe, rate, and give us a review if you like. Like, follow, and subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on. Thanks, guys. It's been great talking to you this week. We'll be back next week.
I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat.